Good morning. This is Maggie Jones in Natural Wonders. Today, I'll be reading the July chapter of A Sand County Almanac by Alda Leopold. I think often about books, and I'm deeply grateful that people have written things down. Imagine that there was no way for people to write and communicate with future generations. We might never have known them if they had not written things down. Our world would be like a shallow flat land. Leopold is an antidote for me, a balm. My vision puts me with him, sitting, watching the dark of early morning become a pale light, the bats return, and more birds sing, always a reason for delight. I'm so grateful to the Alda Leopold Foundation for permission to read his words here for all of us. And the first part of the July chapter is called Great Possessions. 120 acres, according to the county clerk, is the extent of my worldly domain. But the county clerk is a sleepy fellow who never looks at his record books before 9 o'clock. What they would show at daybreak is the question here at issue. Books or no books, it is a fact, patent both to my dog and myself, that at daybreak I am the sole owner of all the acres I can walk over. It's not only boundaries that disappear, but also the thought of being bounded. Expanses unknown to deed or map are known to every dawn and solitude, perhaps no longer to exist in my county, extends on every hand as far as the dew can reach. Like other great landowners, I have tenants. They are negligent about rents, but very punctilious about tenures. Indeed, at every daybreak from April to July, they proclaim their boundaries to each other and so acknowledge, at least by inference, their fiefdom to me. This daily ceremony, contrary to what you might suppose, begins with the utmost decorum. Who originally laid down its protocols, I do not know. At 3:30 a.m., with such dignity as I can muster of a July morning, I step from my cabin door, bearing in either hand my emblems of sovereignty, a coffee pot, and a notebook. I seat myself on a bench facing the white wake of the morning star. I set the pot beside me. I extract a cup from my shirt front, hoping none will notice its informal mode of transport. I get out my watch, pour coffee, and lay notebook on knee. This is the cue for the proclamations to begin. At 3:35, the nearest field sparrow avows in a clear tenor chant that he holds the jack pine copse north to the riverbank and south to the old wagon track. One by one, all the other field sparrows within earshot recite their respective holdings. There are no disputes, at least at this hour, so I just listen, hoping inwardly that their womenfolk acquiesce in this happy accord over the status quo ante. Before the field sparrows have quite gone the rounds, the robin in the big elm warbles loudly his claim to the crotch where the ice storm tore off a limb and all appurtenances pertaining thereto, meaning in his case all the angleworms in the not very spacious subjacent lawn. The robin's insistent caroling awakens the oriole, who now tells the world of orioles that the pendant branch of the elm belongs to him, together with all fiber-bearing milkweed stalks nearby, all loose strings in the garden, and the exclusive right to flash like a burst of fire from one of these to another. My watch says 3:50. The indigo bunting on the hill asserts title to the dead oak limb left by the 1936 drought and to divers nearby bugs and bushes. He does not claim, but I think he implies, the right to outblue all bluebirds and all spiderworts that have turned their faces to the dawn. Next, the wren, the one who discovered the knothole in the eave of the cabin, explodes into song. Half a dozen other wrens give voice, and now all is bedlam. Grosbeaks, thrashers, yellow warblers, bluebirds, vireos, towhees, cardinals, all are at it. My solemn list of performers in their order and time of first song hesitates, wavers, ceases, for my ear can no longer filter out priorities. Besides, the pot is empty and the sun is about to rise. I must inspect my domain before my title runs out. We sally forth, the dog and I, at random. He has paid scant respect to all these vocal goings-on, for to him the evidence of tenantry is not song, but scent. Any illiterate bundle of feathers, he says, can make a noise in a tree. Now he's going to translate for me the olfactory poems that who knows what silent creatures have written in the summer night. At the end of each poem sits the author, if we can find him. What we actually find is beyond predicting. A rabbit suddenly yearning to be elsewhere, a woodcock fluttering his disclaimer, a cock pheasant indignant over wetting his feathers in the grass. Once in a while we turn up a coon or a mink, returning late from the night's foray. Sometimes we rout a heron from his unfinished fishing, or surprise a mother wood duck with her convoy of ducklings, headed full steam for the shelter of the pickerel weeds. Sometimes we see deer sauntering back to the thickets replete with alfalfa blooms, veronica, and wild lettuce. More often we see only the interweaving darkened lines that lazy hoofs have traced on the silken fabric of the dew. I can feel the sun now. The bird chorus has run out of breath. The far clank of cowbells bespeaks a herd ambling to pasture. A tractor roars, warning that my neighbor is astir. The world has shrunk to those mean dimensions known to county clerks. We've turned towards home and breakfast. The next part of the July chapter is called Prairie Birthday. During every week from April to September, there are, on the average, 10 wild plants coming into first bloom. In June, as many as a dozen species may burst their buds in a single day. No man can heed all of these anniversaries. No man can ignore all of them. He who steps unseeing on May dandelions may be hauled up short by August ragweed pollen. He who ignores the ruddy haze of April elms may skid his car on the fallen corollas of June catalpas. Tell me of what plant birthday a man takes notice, and I shall tell you a good deal about his vocation, his hobbies, his hay fever, and the general level of his ecological education. Every July, I watch eagerly a certain country graveyard that I pass in driving to and from my farm. It is time for a prairie birthday, and in one corner of this graveyard lives a surviving celebrant of that once important event. It is an ordinary graveyard, bordered by the usual spruces and studded with the usual pink granite or white marble headstones, each with the usual Sunday bouquet of red or pink geraniums. It is extraordinary only in being triangular instead of square, and in harboring, within the sharp angle of its fence, a pinpoint remnant of the native prairie on which the graveyard was established in the 1840s. Heretofore unreachable by scythe or mower, this yard-square relic of original Wisconsin gives birth, each July, to a man-high stalk of compass plant, or cut-leaf silphium, spangled with saucer-sized yellow blooms resembling sunflowers. It is the sole remnant of this plant along this highway, and perhaps the sole remnant of the western half of our county. What 1,000 acres of silphiums looked like when they tickled the bellies of the buffalo is a question never again to be answered, and perhaps not even asked. This year I found the silphium in first bloom on 24 July, a week later than usual. During the last 6 years, the average date was 15 July. When I passed the graveyard again on 3 August, the fence had been removed by a road crew and the silphium cut. It is easy now to predict the future. For a few years, my silphium will try in vain to rise above the mowing machine, and then it will die. With it will die the prairie epoch. The highway department says that 100,000 cars pass yearly over this route during the 3 summer months when the silphium is in bloom. In them must ride at least 100,000 people who have taken what is called history, and perhaps 25,000 who have taken what is called botany. Yet I doubt whether a dozen have seen the silphium, and of these hardly one will notice its demise. If I were to tell a preacher of the adjoining church that the road crew has been burning history books in his cemetery under the guise of mowing weeds, he would be amazed and uncomprehending. How could a weed be a book? This is one little episode in the funeral of the native flora, which in turn is one episode in the funeral of the floras of the world. Mechanized man, oblivious of floras, is proud of his progress in cleaning up the landscape on which, willy-nilly, he must live out his days. It might be wise to prohibit at once all teaching of real botany and real history, lest some future citizens suffer qualms about the floristic price of his good life. Thus it comes to pass that farm neighborhoods are good in proportion to the poverty of their floras. My own farm was selected for its lack of goodness and its lack of highway. Indeed, my whole neighborhood lies in a backwash of the River Progress. My road is the original wagon track of the pioneers, innocent of grades or gravel, brushings or bulldozers. My neighbors bring a sigh to the county agent. Their fence rows go unshaven for years on end. Their marshes are neither diked nor drained. As between going fishing and going forward, they are prone to prefer fishing. Thus, on weekends, my floristic standard of living is that of the backwoods, while on weekdays I subsist as best I can on the flora of the university farms, the university campus, and the adjoining suburbs. For a decade I have kept for pastime a record of the wild plant species in first bloom on these two diverse areas. And his records show that during the summer there are twice as many species first blooming on the farm as there are in his campus world. It is apparent that the backward farmer's eye is nearly twice as well fed as the eye of the university student or businessman. Of course, neither sees his flora as yet, so we are confronted by the two alternatives already mentioned: either ensure the continued blindness of the populace, or examine the question whether we cannot have both progress and plants. The shrinkage in the flora is due to a combination of clean farming, woodlot grazing, and good roads. Each of these necessary changes, of course, requires a larger reduction in the acreage available for wild plants, but none of them requires or benefits by the erasure of species from whole farms, townships, or counties. There are idle spots on every farm, and every highway is bordered by an idle strip as long as it is. Keep cow, plow, and mower out of these idle spots, and the full native flora, plus dozens of interesting stowaways from foreign parts, could be part of the normal environment of every citizen. The outstanding conservator of the prairie flora, ironically enough, knows little and cares less about such frivolities. It is the railroad with its fenced right-of-way. Many of these railroad fences were erected before the prairie had been plowed. Within these linear reservations, oblivious of cinders, soot, and annual cleanup fires, the prairie flora still splashes its calendar of colors from pink shooting stars in May to blue aster in October. I have long wished to confront some hard-boiled railway president with the physical evidence of his soft-heartedness. I have not done so because I haven't met one. The railroads, of course, use flamethrowers and chemical sprays to clear the track of weeds, but the cost of such necessary clearance is still too high to extend it much beyond the actual rails. Perhaps further improvements are in the offing. The erasure of a human subspecies is largely painless to us if we know little enough about it. We grieve only for what we know. The erasure of silphium from Western Dane County is no cause for grief if one knows it only as a name in a botany book. Silphium first became a personality to me when I tried to dig one up to move to my farm. It was like digging an oak sapling. After half an hour of hot, grimy labor, the root was still enlarging, like a great vertical sweet potato. As far as I know, that silphium root went clear through to bedrock. I got no silphium, but I learned by what elaborate underground stratagems it contrives to weather the prairie droughts. I next planted silphium seeds, which are large, meaty, and taste like sunflower seeds. They came up promptly, but after 5 years of waiting, the seedlings are still juvenile and have not yet borne a flower stalk. Perhaps it takes a decade for a silphium to reach flowering age. How old, then, was my pet plant in the cemetery? It may have been older than the oldest tombstone, which dated 1850. Perhaps it watched the fugitive blackhawk retreat from the Madison Lakes to the Wisconsin River. It stood on the route of the famous march. Certainly it saw the successive funerals of the local pioneers as they retired one by one to their repose beneath the blue stem. I once saw a power shovel, while digging a roadside ditch, sever the sweet potato root of a silphium plant. The root soon sprouted new leaves, and eventually it again produced a flower stalk. This explains why this plant, which never invades new ground, is nevertheless sometimes seen on recently graded roadsides. Once established, it apparently withstands almost any kind of mutilation, except continued grazing, mowing, or plowing. Why does silphium disappear from grazed areas? I once saw a farmer turn his cows into a virgin prairie meadow, previously used only sporadically for mowing wild hay. The cows cropped the silphium to the ground before any other plant was visibly eaten at all. One can imagine that the buffalo once had the same preference for silphium, but he brooked no fences to confine his nibblings all summer long to one meadow. In short, the buffalo's pasturing was discontinuous and therefore tolerable to silphium. It is a kind providence that has withheld a sense of history from the thousands of species of plants and animals that have exterminated each other to build the present world. The same kind providence now withholds it from us. Few grieved when the last buffalo left Wisconsin, and few will grieve when the last silphium follows him to the lush prairies of the Never Never Land. And that's the end of the July chapter of Sand County Almanac, published originally in 1949, a year after Leopold's death, at age 60. We're so fortunate that people have woken up to the destruction of plant communities and rallied to the silphium and other prairie plants. I want to remind you about the prairie enthusiasts, and you can look up their prairie sites, and you can visit their sites, theprairieenthusiasts.org, with quite a lot of detail about the history of the sites. And this would be a great time to go and see the beautiful blooming. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thank you for listening.